The Second World War is the largest event in human history.
A 20-part series with Tom Hanks.
No part of the globe was untouched. No life unchanged.
Experience the ultimate account of World War II.
Every single person had a story. These are the stories that make us who we are.
Listen to World War II with Tom Hanks on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Actually, Esme's off tonight. It's Moose Miller in for Esme Murphy here on WCCO. Professor Dave Schultz is with us from Hamline University in the Poli Sci Department. Professor, I've been looking forward to this conversation. I always enjoy visiting with you when I sit in and fill in for Esme.
Yeah, it's always fun. We were just talking to your producer off the air a little bit here and saying that I think over the years we've talked quite a few times. I just can't remember the last time we talked, though.
Yeah, I want to say it's probably been about 6 months. I'm in Jupiter, Florida. Or I was. I'm in Tampa, Florida this evening. We're over helping some friends that are trying to move out of a condo they're going to sell here at the end of the month that luckily did not get destroyed by Hurricane Irma. But I was looking at, you know, some of our topics of conversation here, and one of them is hurricanes and how they've changed U.S. politics. And, you know, as I look at, you know, the flooding and the devastation here in Florida and Harvey, the coverage that we've seen there. And it's been interesting to watch the Republican contingent out of Texas that didn't want to give up, you know, money for the hurricane victims of Sandy up in New Jersey and parts of New York because there was so much pork in that. Right. Well, now the shoe's on the other foot.
Yeah, it's really interesting to watch at this point, because you're right, because I think when, if I remember correctly, with Hurricane Sandy, it was that the relief that would be provided to the individuals up there had to be offset with some cuts that were going to be made to other types of programs. And you're right, they were concerned about issues such as how it was going to affect the deficit or whether this is an appropriate role for the federal government. And suddenly we saw with, you know, Hurricane Harvey, and I suspect we're going to see, you know, with the Florida hurricane too, you know, increasingly mounted pressure, you know, from Republicans to say that, well, you know, we need to, you know, we need to take care of our people here. And so you wonder, Besides hypocrisy, and we know both parties are guilty of hypocrisy, just no question about that. It'll be curious to see the longer term, you know, consequences in terms of how Republicans might start to view not just providing relief like this, but I also think it has something to do with sort of coming to the realization that maybe the earth is heating up and maybe we're going to have more violent hurricanes in the future.
Oh, for sure. You know, it was interesting, too. I was down here when President Trump arrived in Naples the other day to inspect the hurricane damage. And you know, I got to say, I think his FEMA director is just a top-notch guy. He's really on top of things. Craig Fugate, who was in the Obama administration, came out of Miami and clearly had a lot of hurricane disaster preparation type of background. And the guy that we got now is a top-notch person. And yet I was kind of struck by, you know, the president taking that moment to, you know, console people. And he's also talking about how Governor Rick Scott has got to run for Senate so that they can, you know, knock Bill Nelson out, the Democrat here in Florida. And I was like, wow, is that really the right time and place to be making that kind of a comment?
Yeah, I don't think it is. I mean, it's kind of like when he went down, Trump, and gave that first speech, you know, after Harvey, where he talked about how big the crowd was that came to see him.
Yeah.
It's sort of the same thing. It's like, that's not the place to do it. I mean, what you're supposed to go down there for is first, is you know words about consoling others, about trying to find out information, what you can do to help others and so forth, because at the end of the day, it's not supposed to be about you at that point.
Well, let's turn our attention here to just some really strange bedfellows moments here with the Trump White House. When you've got him, he had dinner with Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer. And I honestly, I think that's great because, you know, President Reagan used to get together with Tip O'Neill and they could actually hash and work stuff out.
Yep.
But I thought it was interesting that he had froze out Mitch McConnell and some of these, you know, Paul Ryans of the world. And it was like, whoa, this is really getting interesting.
It is getting interesting, and this is going to connect back to our previous, you know, conversation here about hurricanes also. But let's think about, you know, how Trump was able to get the deal in terms of getting the $9 billion for relief, you know, for Hurricane Harvey. It was when he approached Congress, and you would think that he's a Republican. Paul Ryan's a Republican. Mitch McConnell's a Republican. Republicans control Congress. It would be a piece of cake for him to be able to, you know, get the relief that he needs for what? A Republican area. But that sort of really hard right wing of the Republican Party was fighting him on that issue, trying to tie that to, again, perhaps, you know, the raising the debt ceiling limit, a whole bunch of different things. He wasn't really getting anywhere. And turn to Pelosi, turn to the Chuck Schumer, and said, "Can we work out a deal here?" And got a deal there. And I think that's pretty significant, because I think most of us would criticize politics in the United States, where it looks like no one's working across aisles. You know, there's criticism, for example, that Obamacare was passed without a Republican vote, and then when they tried to repeal Obamacare, almost no Democrat, I think it was, what, no Democratic votes. And so right yeah. now, the idea of saying that the president is starting to figure out how to create a working coalition composed of Democrats and some moderate Republicans, to me, is not a bad thing to have happen. It's about what? The kind of bipartisanship that you, as you pointed out, that we saw with yeah. Reagan and Tip O'Neill.
Well, and it, you know, I'd look at when we passed the Affordable Care Act. That was ridiculous. You did not have a single Republican vote on that. Mm-hmm. But to then have 7 years to come up with a plan.
Yes.
And then now you've got a supermajority, and you don't have anything to speak for on this. It's inexcusable. I always use the analogy of, it's the dog that caught the car. Okay, what are you going to do now? You don't know what to do. You had 7 years to come up with a plan.
No, that's exactly it. It's tough to be an adult. It's tough to govern, and that's sort of how I describe it here. Is that we were in the Republicans were in the opposition, and they knew that they didn't actually have to put up something. It was easy to would they repeal it like 50 or 60 times or something like that?
Yep.
But you would have thought, and remember Trump, when he was running for president, said that we'll come up with a terrific plan. I think it was a terrific plan or something like that. And there's been so much time to do something, but you're right. They never had anything.
Well, and to, you know, see 50 to 60 some bills that were put on President Obama's desk that he obviously, you know, vetoed and struck down to repeal Obamacare during those times. And now you can't get one of them with Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell to get to the president's desk. I just don't understand.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. And this is, and again, this sort of has been the problem for both Trump and I think the Republicans for, let's say these 9 months here, is that, yes, the Republicans in Congress had plenty of time to really come up with an alternative and could have perhaps even proposed fixes, because we do know that the Affordable Care Act needs to be fixed. But, A, Congress hasn't come up with really good alternatives. And as we know, it wound up, the suggestions they had would have taken away health care for, what, 20 or 25 million people. But with Trump, one of the things that has struck me consistently, you know, from almost day one of his presidency, is what seems to be the inability to learn from mistakes, or the inability to sort of have some kind of strategy or plan for how to do things and how to move legislation. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why the potential deals with Democrats right now are interesting. Is it either a sign that the Trump administration is finally learning how to play Washington, or is it just sort of, you know, who knows? You know, he's sort of going back and forth between playing Republicans off Democrats with no real strategy. It's not clear yet which it is.
You know, the DACA situation, I think, has been rather revealing, in that, you know, you've got Republicans that are having to come to face the music on, you know, the ramifications and what's ultimately going to happen here. You know, the bigger issue is that you've got people that will come to this country that will work for, you know, maybe a lower wage, But ultimately, at the end of the day, who's responsible for paying that wage? You know, if you're going to bang the drum and say that you don't want those people here, well, then, you know, pay a more livable wage that, you know, people will do those jobs. I grew up in Iowa, and I remember IBP and a lot of these big, you know, meat packing plants and companies like that. They paid pretty good money, you know, up to the 80s and around there. And then the wages started to drop and, you know, the unions started to go away. And suddenly those jobs, you ask most people, you want to take that job? No.
No,
I don't want to do that.
Yeah. Today I was out in the Wilmer area. And if you go out to Wilmer, go out a little bit further, even west of there, big sugar beet area, big area where a lot of people, you know, Mexican-Americans and a lot of migrant workers will come in and help do the harvest. And I mention that because it's very hard work, and the wages aren't always the best in the world. And I doubt you or I or most of our listeners would be willing to do that kind of work all day. And your point is exceedingly well taken, is that, and there's probably a connection here between the fact that there hasn't been significant increases in the minimum wage at the federal level in many years, that there's a decrease in the number of people who are in unions and hardly unionized, and for a while there, also the fact that immigration was let's say illegal immigration was dramatically growing at this point. All those things kind of come together in terms of perhaps fueling some of what's going on here.
Sure.
And we really haven't thought about policy in a kind of constructive way to try to think of the underlying social and economic reasons as to why many people who are Mexicans came to the United States, sometimes not legally, and has a lot to do with really economics.
Well, and you know, case in point, Postville, Iowa, and you look at, you know, the meat processing plant that went on there, and it's, you know, that American Greed episode runs probably, you know, once every 4 or 5 months. But, you know, ultimately, look at the guys at the top. They were the ones that were like, yeah, let's just push those wages down, and we don't care who we get in here to do this work. You know, you brought this on yourself.
There's no question about it. At the same time, that their wages went up dramatically as CEOs, and they were doing very, very well in the process here. No, I think there's lots of blame to sort of be cast around in terms of what businesses did, in terms of the fact that they weren't willing to pay living wages. They were willing to sort of say that, okay, you know, our company is going to thrive off of essentially encouraging people to come to the United States who might not have appropriate documentation, and we're going to pay them essentially under the table or with sub living wages. And that's why some people have said that, well, on a variety of other things, the reforms have to go with, better either enforcement at that level in terms of targeting the businesses who are hiring them, or B, a combination of targeting them and saying that if we don't want to have increases in immigration, we need to rethink our entire immigration policy and rethink, again, our own wage structure in the United States.
Sure. Professor Schultz, when we come back here, I'm going to be curious to hear what you think or how you think this DACA situation is going to play out with Republicans and Democrats, you know, and do we see something that gets done here by the end of the year, or is this, you know, a can that gets kicked into the 2018 midterms, which I would think if you're a Republican, you want to put this thing to bed now rather than have to deal with this thing in a 2018 midterm attack ad world. We'll continue with Professor Schultz here on WCCO Radio. It's Moose Miller in tonight for Esme Murphy. 8:26 on this Saturday night. Moose Miller in tonight for Esme Murphy here on WCCO. We're visiting with Professor David Schultz from Hamline University, talking poli-sci and so much more here. DACA has been where we left off the conversation. Where do you see or how do you see this playing out with regard to Republicans? Do they come to the table on this, or is it truly going to be Democrats that, with the president, push something through and this six-month window will not be a factor for 700,000-800,000 kids here in this country?
Well, right now, I think if it happens, it's going to happen with Democrats, and it'll be obviously some Republicans because there's not enough votes, of course, with just Democrats. But what we don't really have at this point is really an actual piece of legislation or agreement. I think what we have between Trump and the Democrats is sort of an agreement to work on an agreement. And so in theory, there might be a blueprint out there that says they're going to do something. But as we know, the devil is in the details. So that's the first thing to think about. The second thing to think about here is that I think for a certain core number of Republicans, whether that number is 50 or 60 or so, I'm not sure where it is that they're never going to come around on this issue. That if they were probably to support any kind of changes in immigration that would allow for the DACA individuals to stay in the United States, they would probably face intense challenges next year in the House of Representatives in terms of their elections. And so I think that group is just never going to be with Trump whatsoever on this, no matter what. And so I think what we're starting to see here is perhaps an effort by Trump that we might be able to have something happen in terms of DACA. But where I want us to take our conversation, though, is to ask why he did this. Why did he sort of first come out and say he's going to get rid of DACA and then eventually say he's going to preserve it? And I would say is that after Harvey, where he carved the deal with Democrats, I think he wanted to throw something to hardcore Republicans in terms of something, get rid of DACA. And then I think public opinion polls suggested that most of us probably want to probably help the DACA people, because people forget these are kids who were brought to the United States not by their own choice. And maybe he's figuring out that there might be some good reason to do this in terms of public support.
I don't understand how 30% of the elected politicians in Washington control the agenda like they do. Mm-hmm. Look at the Steve King contingents of the world and the other representative out of, is it North or South Carolina, that, that's incredibly far right to, the Bernie Sanders far left of, the Democratic Party. But I just don't get how they're driving the bus, and this DACA thing isn't going to go away. And
the DACA is not going to go away. And in fact, the immigration issues aren't going to go away. I mean, we've needed to reform our immigration laws for 25, 30, if not 40 years. Mm-hmm. And what's happened at this point, because of the way the Republican Party is set up, there is, and the Democratic Party has that too, but more, in this case, Republican Party, there's a core number of people who can supply enough votes for legislative victories, but who don't want to go along with the rest of the party. And they've essentially been the veto on things anywhere from DACA to raising money for hurricane relief to fixing Obamacare, et cetera, et cetera. And so we really do have a political system right now that seems to be held hostage by the extremists, and it's making it difficult in a polarized world for one party to be able to do anything. And therefore, we need to, as we talked about at the beginning of the show, figure out ways of being able to get presidents and leaders to talk to people across the aisles and across parties to accomplish anything.
My simple take on that is, it's going to be years before you can get things to change because of the way that congressional districts have been so gerrymandered up into such a hyper-partisan, super Democrat or super Republican approach to things. And, people can, in those districts, if it's, redistrict to fit for a Republican or a Democrat, you can hold those positions and know you're going to be reelected.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, just look at Minnesota, for example. I mean, in Minnesota, we've got, let's say, in Minneapolis and St. Paul, two Democratic districts that a Republican's never going to win. And then we've got some districts in this state, for example, up going through St. Cloud and that a Democrat's not going to win. There's essentially no serious challenge in some of those districts. And a lot of it has to do, certainly not all of it, but a lot of it has to do with the way those districts are drawn and the fact that there's no serious need for candidates or representatives in the areas to move to the center.
Yeah, well, you know, and I will give some props to our friends to the south in Iowa. The way that they've, you know, carved the state up district-wise, it's pretty, you know, even, a lot of straight lines there.
Yeah, and part of why they do that, Iowa is one of the few states in the country that has taken redistricting out of the legislators' hands, and it's a nonpartisan redistricting commission, and
yeah.
It works exceedingly well.
Yeah, and I would respectfully submit that I think we need to be looking at that across the country. You look at Illinois, you look at Texas, Florida. It's just the way these districts are carved, California. It's just ridiculous. Well, we'll come back here. I want to get your thoughts, Professor, on Governor Dayton and what's happening with the, well, they're going to mediation and, right. And maybe, you know, Judge Solem will run for governor because he sure seems to be, you know, getting pulled into a lot of mediation cases.
That's right.
At the pretty high level. And we've also got to talk about North Korea. That's a situation that, man, it's got some pretty serious consequences. When we come back here after a look at the weather on WCCO.
Perfect.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
Professor David Schultz is with us from Hamline University. Moose Miller in tonight for Esme Murphy on WCCO. And Esme always has some great conversations with Professor Schultz. And we're just trying to live up to that reputation here. We've moved on to Governor Dayton, who had some vetoes that have now been pushed to the point where retired Hennepin County Judge Rick Solem is going to have to mediate a budget dispute between the legislature and the governor over these line item vetoes. And we're kind of up against the clock here on some of this stuff, aren't we?
We are, because the legislature has enough funding to last, at least from a temporary order, until October 1st, and we don't know how much further beyond that the legislature has money, and so that's part of the issue here. But the whole issue here is really fascinating, because it was the governor, I started back even further, it was the legislature putting a variety of things in several bills that the governor didn't like. He decided to sign them because of fear that if he didn't sign them, we might go into another shutdown. He then, as a way of getting even with the legislature, line item vetoed out the funding for the legislature. Case went and said, I want certain things for to restore your funding. Legislature decided to go to court to sue. They prevailed in Ramsey County District Court. It went up to the Minnesota Supreme Court. And I would describe what the Minnesota Supreme Court did as a massive punt. What they did is to say that the governor's line item veto was constitutional. They also said that the legislature was entitled to have adequate funding. And then it said in the next paragraph, we're going to let the political process resolve this and send it back to the governor and to the legislature to mediate and work the whole thing out. And I don't know about you, I am skeptical regarding how well the governor and the legislature will be able to work things out or mediate things out, because if they could have, they would have done that already.
Yeah, and then you've also got the situation of retired Hennepin County Judge Rick Solem, mm-hmm. who, you know, maybe he should run for governor.
Well, he's essentially at this point going to be sort of acting like a power broker in terms of trying to get him together. And that is also interesting, whether or not the Minnesota Supreme Court can actually order the governor and the legislature into mediation. What if one or both of them had said, no, we're not going to do that? What could the court have done to them? And so this entire story just seems to be getting stranger and stranger in terms of what's happening, where we want the governor and legislature to work together. They don't. They go to court. We hope the court will resolve it. The court says we don't want to solve it, sends it back to them. Then it says, but you're going to then get a court-ordered mediator to work with you. If it sounds confusing, it really is, and I'm not sure it really makes a lot of sense.
Well, and, you know, what does mediation, you know, bear out? What is the compromise between these two that, you know, yeah. ultimately will become of this? Otherwise, you know, we're looking at an October deadline here that, you know, now different government agencies are going to be shutting down and closing, and layoffs are going to start to happen.
Well, that's a good question, because it'll be the legislature that will potentially be closing, which means it's not just legislators who don't get paid. It will be the staff. It'll be the people who work there, and that's really the question here, is in terms of what's the point of compromise? At the end of the day, Dayton is saying there are certain things that I want. The legislature is saying no, we don't want to go along with those. I mean, right now, I don't see a lot of compromise, room for compromise, and then throw into this politics where I think it's going to be hard for many of the legislators to give in to the governor and then go back and face their constituents, in 2018. So I don't see a lot of, sort of political forces coming together that would encourage the governor and the legislature, the Republican legislature, to actually work together and resolve this matter.
Sure. Let's move on to North Korea, because, once again, the president of North Korea has thought it was a good idea to test more of these ballistic missiles and ended up launching another one over northern Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And sooner or later, somebody's going to mess up on probably the North Korean side of things and lob something over artillery rise or whatever that's a mistake, but then catapults this thing into a full-scale war.
No, you're right. And this is what's dangerous here, is that, North Korea and the United States are kind of playing a game of chicken with one another of who's going to blink first or who's going to do something first, on top of which partly where I thought you were going to go for a second here is shoot one of those missiles over Japan, and if it malfunctions or does something wrong, and let's say it lands and hits one of the major cities or something like that, it just seems right now that there's kind of a momentum going towards some type of showdown where North Korea keeps defying the United States. The Trump administration keeps saying all options are on the table, including military options, and we seem to go through almost weekly sort of, was it ramping up the rhetoric and then ramping down the rhetoric, but at the end of the day, there is this sort of underlying reality of the fact that North Korea has nuclear capabilities at this point, and what does the United States do, and what are our options, and what is Trump prepared to do, and all of these are questions that I wish I had the answers to, but these are very, very tough questions in terms of where the United States is moving, and it's just not clear that the United States can prevent North Korea from having nuclear weapons, mm-hmm. and it's not even clear that if we were to go to war with them, that would necessarily lead out to a satisfactory ending for the United States.
Well, I guess what scares me is, as you end game out that the capabilities of the North Koreans are going to continue to grow, and as they start to miniaturize some of these nuclear devices, that you can embargo them and strangle them, and economically they're going to have to come up with ways to generate revenue.
Mm-hmm.
One of them is, why wouldn't they consider selling some of those devices to terrorist groups around the world?
No, I absolutely agree at this point, is that they're in a position of being able to sell some of that nuclear material, maybe those devices,
mm-hmm.
Or even the technology for it. So there's lots of scary potentials out there for it. The other thing is it just doesn't seem as if at this point, even with all the sanctions that are being ramped up against them, that those can be 100% secure. I mean, I was reading the other day that even though, for example, China has cut back dramatically on some of the trade with North Korea, I saw a story that said that Russia now is stepping in terms of providing some aid or some trade in terms of what, oil or or fuels or something like that, and as a way of generating revenue for Russia, but also as a way of supporting North Korea, with the idea that North Korea is going to continue to needle the United States. And so we can't really seal North Korea up, in a way that it can't generate revenue in some way.
Well, and Russia and China, to me, are such keys in this, but it's not in their best interest to want to cooperate along those lines to really put the screws to North Korea.
No, I agree. I think they have their own interests, and I think they have their own goals in terms of what they want to achieve. And I do think right now they are looking for ways to, again, at least Russia is, to needle the United States. But also this points to, I think, the fact that I do think China is limited in terms of what it can do with North Korea. And there seems to be tremendous frustration because I don't think China wants North Korea as a nuclear rival, and I don't think it wants to have North Korea destabilizing China or destabilizing Asia and causing problems for China.
Mm-hmm. And finally, I kept this topic for the end of our conversation here. Senator Franken of Minnesota finally kind of came out and declared, yeah, I'm for single payer. I like Bernie Sanders' approach to this. And I wonder, you know, if you know, his stepping forward on this officially is going to signal a bigger push in even probably 2018 for obviously Democrats to push for a single payer plan and use that as some type of wedge in the midterm election cycle.
I think you're right. I think what we're seeing is that the Democrats view on both the single payer and health insurance reform, especially in light of the fact that, again, that the Republicans' effort failed. I think they're seeing health care and perhaps a couple of other issues as ways of appealing to the liberal base of their party, as a way of trying to define themselves in the 2018 elections. Because I would say right now, while the Democrats potentially have an opportunity to do well in 2018. Historically, a president's party does very badly in midterm elections of a first term. So there's lots of things that suggest that Democrats might do well, but what they need is a strategy and they need a message. And perhaps they're thinking that coming out in favor of single-payer health care is one way of doing that.
Well, yeah, it's the only horse I see them riding right now. And unfortunately, they don't really have a candidate that can ride on that horse presidentially.
Right. Yeah, I think you're right. I think the Democrats are still a party in search of a message. You know, a few months ago when Chuck Schumer came out with that slogan, what was it called, a better deal or something like that, that pretty much fell flat. And I think the Democrats have been hoping for, and in many ways, this was Hillary Clinton's campaign last year, was the belief of saying that, well, Democrats will, or people will realize that Republicans are not very good, not very strong, or Trump's an idiot, or whatever it is, and therefore we will do well simply by running against him. And the reality is, you have to be a party that stands for something, that has some kind of beliefs in order to succeed.
Yeah. Well, I always felt Trump had a really strong chance of winning just because if you spend any time out in this country, there's a lot of people that really still agree with a lot of what the president says. Mm-hmm. And, you know, privately, they agree to that. And, you know, it may not be right in certain respects, but I think you also have to respect that that's the way some people feel. I think the better question is, why do they feel that way?
I think you're absolutely correct, and I think one of the things that Trump tapped into that is still out there is the fact that there are many, many people for the last 25 or 30 years that have really been left aside by the U.S. economy. I mean, just think about it in terms of Minnesota. You know, go up to the Iron Range, for example, you know, with a lot of the former miners and people like that. They sort of feel like, you know, the government has done very little to help them, has done very little in terms of addressing their needs. And across the Midwest, which is where Trump did very well in terms of winning the presidency, there are a lot of people anywhere from the old auto industry to the steel industry to fiberglass to mining that feel like no one's been listening to them. And the Democrat, and that's partly what fueled Trump's success, partly what fueled in part Bernie Sanders. But going into 2018, unless the Democrats can figure out some way of articulating a set of ideas that captures or appeals to these people, one shouldn't necessarily think that 2018 is going to be a banner year for them.
And probably a great place to leave our conversation. Professor Schultz, great. Thank you so much for your time this evening.
No problem. Anytime, Moose, and I look forward to talking to you in the future.
You got it. Professor David Schultz joining us from Hamline University here on WCCO. It is 8:50. It's Moose Miller in tonight for Esme Murphy on 830 WCCO. Well, in the few minutes that we have left here on the Esme Murphy Show on WCCO, Moose Miller in tonight for Esme, I wanted to focus in on Facebook on a number of levels and angles. Number one, we didn't get a chance to talk with Professor Schultz about this, but I'm sure in the future we will be talking about Mark Zuckerberg and his political aspirations. But I thought it was interesting this past week, Facebook was taken to task by, I think it was ProPublica, that pointed out Facebook's been making money off of its ability to offer up advertising that's highly targeted. That's no secret. But they were doing it, for example, if you wanted to reach neo-Nazis and white supremacists, there was a way that you could use the Facebook algorithm to specifically target Jew haters and stuff like that, that you could actually type into the search algorithm to hyper-reach or hyper-target those types of individuals. And they were taken to task for it. Really? Is that something you should be doing? And then tonight I was reading here in Bloomberg Politics that Facebook, relative to the Mueller special counsel investigation, is providing copies of ads and explaining how they were targeted and who bought them to the Mueller investigators. So this is on top of a bunch of information that Facebook shared with Congress this last week, as the Wall Street Journal was reporting on it as well. The information is relevant to Special Counsel Mueller as they're trying to understand whether there were any links between Russia's activity and President Donald Trump's campaign. We'll see what ultimately that bears out. But I don't think we'd have much doubt that Russia was definitely meddling in this election. Whether or not they were in cahoots with the Trump campaign, that's a question that still remains to be answered. But when you've got $100,000 in ad spending connected to fake accounts that emanate back to Russia, that's facts. That's indisputable. And we'll have to wait and see, you know, if tentacles get connected out to certain political operatives or types within the Trump campaign. That may or may not ever happen. But I think it's pretty certain at this point Russia was meddling in the election. We'll check in with CBS World and National News coming up here at the top of the hour. I'm Moose Miller. Thanks for allowing us into your home this evening on WCCO.
Welcome to Radio Rental. The scariest stories you've ever heard in your life. All told by real people. And off we go.
This wasn't a human being that I saw. There's something here in this house. Something not of this world.
There was a woman moving through the hall. I stepped back and I was completely alone.
Radio Rental is available now. Listen for free on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.